Blog Talk Radio.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex.
About sex for now, to the people at home or in the crowd, it keeps coming up anyhow. Don't be coy, avoid, or make void the topic,
cause that ain't gonna stop it.
Now we talk about sex on the radio and video show.
Many will know
anything goes. Let's tell it like it is and how it could be, how it was, and of course how it should be. Those who think it's dirty have a choice: pick up the needle, press pause, or turn the radio off. Will that stop us then?
I doubt it.
All right then, come on, spin.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about sex.
Radio show is for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
If you're a parent and you have a teenage son and or daughter, do you think you did a good job teaching your children about sex, sexually transmitted diseases, masturbation, eroticism, intimacy? Here's the harsh reality. If you don't teach your kids all they need to know about sex, someone else will. And more than likely, it will be one or more of their peers. Wouldn't you rather that if someone other than you was going to teach your offspring about sex, it would be someone who has thoroughly studied all the various facets of human sexuality very meticulously and thoroughly? Realistically, there are some people in this country that don't believe sex should be discussed too frankly and or in too much detail. They believe you should simply tell your sons and daughters not to masturbate, to wait until marriage to have sex, or if they get weak, to use a condom. Is that really all that needs to be said in this day and age, the 21st century? At least one woman says emphatically, no, that's not all that needs to be said. My guest for the evening has her own website entitled MySexProfessor.com, and she is very intellectually thorough and entertainingly candid when it comes to discussing any subject related to sexuality. Who is this woman who believes that a 13-year-old teenage girl should know just as much about her own sexuality as a 23-year-old or a 33-year-old woman? Her name is Dr. Debbie Herbenik. And tonight, if you have sons or daughters between the ages of 13 and 17, you need to allow them to listen in the room with you this evening, because on this very important issue regarding the effectiveness of this country's sex education, Dr. Debbie is about to get up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry.
Oh my God, oh my God, is this Alan Roger Curry of Mode 1 fame? Oh my God.
You're really good at this.
I gotta ask you, do you feel that black men have some type of unwritten obligation to date and marry someone in the race? You do?
I think they do. I think white people should date white people. I think black people should date black people.
Now, how did you come up with this idea to go to Italy with the women?
With the women, right. I just got so tired of hearing all my male friends talk about Brazil and how great Brazil is for them.
When I was growing up, I would go and hear about black women complaining about white women are stealing our men. Don't complain about your goods being stolen if you casually leave them on the front porch.
Have sex. Enjoy your life.
You know, men really want women to have standards. They really do. And I don't know how we got off of the mark there, but men do like classy women, and they want women to have standards.
I think you can be single and be very, very happy, and I think it's about taking the pressures off about being married.
I'm not saying that you should disrespect a woman. Never disrespect your woman, but the key is to not let her walk all over you.
Romantic love is very volatile. People don't realize it. And it is a drug. People don't realize it. Men and women do stupid things. Not all men, but sometimes you'll do something stupid.
I think it's a turn-on because just to see that person, just to enjoy themselves and just to watch them touching that person and making them feel good, I think that's kind of sexy, actually.
Yo, yo! Mode 1! This is Gerard McClendon from Chicago Tonight and the McClendon Report. Right now you're listening to Upfront and Straightforward with my good friend, Alan Roger Curry. Mode 1, let the women know, fellas, what you're really thinking. Ha ha, Alan Roger Curry.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network, and I'm your host, Alan Roger Curry, and I'm already, my show ain't even started yet, and I'm already having some technical difficulties, I think, because there's been a thunderstorm in the area, so if anything is off kilter, please bear with me. But my computer and everything is just acting up. But today is Thursday, July 16th, and tonight, I don't know, get your Kleenex out, because tonight is my next to last episode of the summer. That means it's only, including tonight, only two more episodes in summer 09, just like last year, and I mentioned it on a couple of previous episodes, I'm going to be going on hiatus for roughly about 6-7 weeks. And I did that last year, and I got a lot of hate mail. So some of my fans, they was like, man, then if you're going to go on hiatus, then I ain't going to listen to your show no more. Because some people, they get into a regular pattern, regular routine, which I appreciate. A lot of my loyal listeners, they get into a regular pattern, regular routine when listening to my show. It's on their calendar every Thursday evening to listen to my show. But the good news is you got a number of shows in case you missed as archive podcasts. So it's not a total wipeout. You won't get to hear live episodes, but I have a number of archive podcasts beginning with last September going up to now. And even if you go back a little further, I got all kinds of shows from, 2007, first half of 2008. But, yes, tonight is my next to last episode of the summer 2009 season. But hey, let's just enjoy this evening because I have a great interview coming up. But I will return. I will return in mid-September with new shows, new guests, new topics and issues. So once I go on hiatus after next week's show, I will return, I want to say on Thursday, September 17th. Thursday, September 17th is when I will be returning. On this evening's episode, now normally when I talk about sex, I make the lighthearted comment, get the kids out the room, get the teenagers out the room. But this is an episode where I actually want the teenagers in the room, because at least half of our discussion is going to center around the teenagers. We're going to be talking about the strengths and weaknesses of 21st century sex education. We actually kind of touched on this subject once before. If you recall, back in January, I had an interview with a woman I've actually known for a while by the name of Dr. Rachel Ross. And in addition to being a physician, she is actually a sex educator. So a lot of our discussion had to do with sex education. But, you know, I wanted this discussion tonight to take place because I'm really impressed by my guest for the evening. But, yes, you can allow your sons and daughters age 13 to 17 to stay in the room. I'm giving you full permission. You can allow them to stay in the room, and because we're not going to get too X-rated. I mean, it will be provocative, but it won't be such that, you know, the youngsters will be. But let's be real. You know I keep it real on my show. Nowadays, teenagers know as much or more than their parents anyway. So we don't have a generation of blush easy teenagers. I mean, they did a show on one of these morning television talk shows, and I tell you, the things that were coming out the mouths of some of these 11, 12, 13, 14 years old, it made me blush. That's what I'm talking about. It made me blush. So yeah, you know, but you can't have the teenagers in the room, because I'm asking a question to my guests and to my listeners. Do you think middle schools, high schools, and colleges are teaching boys and girls all they need to know about sex, intimacy, sexually transmitted diseases, and birth control? Please call into the show during the course of the conversation and chime in with your thoughts. Chime in with your thoughts. Next week, I will not have any special guests to interview. I will spend most of my show discussing my new podcast series, The Erotic Conversationalist. The Erotic Conversationalist. That's what I will spend most of. See, you know, I have to drop the volume of my voice. The Erotic Conversationalist. That's what I'll be talking about next week. As you can tell, I still have this strained voice. I don't know where this is coming from. I don't know what's going on. My voice is not back to normal. Hopefully it'll return next week. I want to give, as I always do, much love. I always give love to all my listeners, But I always have special love for my chat room, I'm going to start off with my dear close friend. See, this is what I'm talking about. When I say the word loyal listener, my friend Adrian, who in the chat room goes by the name Diva362636. She is in the hospital. She's in the hospital. Seriously, she's in the hospital. She's been suffering from pneumonia. Her husband brought her a laptop in the hospital so she can listen to my show. Is that a loyal listener or what? You got to give it up for Diva. You just got to give it up for that sister. That's what I call a loyal listener. I got my younger cousin, Hype Style is in the chat room. Christopher Curry. I got Hyper in the chat room. I got J-Rock in the chat room. I got Easy E in the chat room. I got Bruce, 6735 in the chat room. And I got the woman with the real seductive voice. Seductive voice. Miss Angel Eyes. Miss Angel Eyes is in my chat room, and I'm sure some of my other listeners and supporters will be coming in. A few other shout-outs will be my brother and ace confidant, Stephen Curry, my cousin, Jason P. Jones, Athabal, Philip Pulliam, and his older brother, Irvin V. Pulliam III. EVP3 is another ace loyal listener. Other shout-outs will be Tyler Collins, Miss Tyler Collins, Deborah Compton, Maurice Taylor, David Ferguson, Mona Stallings, Gerard McClendon, Kathy Holloway Hill, Will Wavy, Steve Dean Williams, Jason 69 Barnes, many of my other Blog Talk Radio colleagues, Facebook buddies. I'm going to work through a couple of technical difficulties, but until I get them worked out, I'm going to go play an intermission, and I'll be right back. What's up, folks? This is Alan Roger Curry of Upfront and Straightforward in Mode 1 fame. And if you're a music lover, I urge you to listen to Madison Media Radio. It's not just music, but it is music with a purpose. Right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network.
Hey, this is Hill Harper, and you can be the difference in the life of a child. Be big. Volunteer with Big Brothers Big Sisters. Do it today. The kids need us. Go to BigBrothersBigSisters.org.
Just so listeners know, there's a letter in my first book, Letters to a Young Brother, Manifest Your Destiny. It's called Finding Your Swagger. In fact, it's so funny. I just got a letter from a young brother that he read my book and it's changed his life. And he also put it in, he said, and you know what? I found my swagger. Now all the girls like me like you said they would. I was so tickled by that. Yeah.
Oh, man, you got to love it.
When I made the movie, it was never my intention to bash black women. What it's about is trying to show black women for the first time that some of the contributions to why relationships don't work actually do come from this.
So online dating actually allows you to get to know someone far better than if you met someone for 20 minutes in a bar.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I agree with Evan Hohart.
We were created to couple up, and I don't care who you are, how successful you think you have it, or how happy of a life you think you would have without a companion. We were created with a longing to couple with someone else.
Only God can judge me, and only God can judge these people. Everyone has the right to live their life, and who am I to judge a person for what they want to do? If it works for you, more power to you. Go ahead.
LA is like a meat market.
don't I know?
I don't know what it is, but somebody's looking for something. So fried chicken is black women to me. I mean, it's just a beautiful thing. I even wrote a poem. Just like chicken.
Ms. McDermott, glad to have you here.
Alan, I'm just feeling a lot of love right now. Yeah, you got me all a tingling, so let's talk about it.
702 is Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry and Jimmy Jean-Louis.
Hey, what's up, Alan? What's up, Jimmy J?
Hey, how are you? Jimmy J, somebody knows me.
Oh, my goodness. Alan.
No, you know, hey.
You're horrible.
What? Welcome back to Upfront and Straightforward. First, I got to tell this story. Did you hear about the girlfriend who was depositing all these tax refunds in her ex-boyfriend's account? $11 million? Wow, man, the things you'll do for love, woo! Man, if I'm her ex-boyfriend, I ain't mad at her. You know, I ain't mad at her. $11 million? Man, that's something. I hope you don't have teenagers that live in Chicago or Cook County, Illinois, because right now, Cook County leads the nation. I just read this today. Cook County leads the nation in reported cases of gonorrhea, and is second in reported cases of chlamydia. Uh-oh. It looks like those teenagers need better sex education. And, of course, you know I'm the master of the clever segue, and that's my segue into my introduction. My guest for the evening is a well-respected professor from my alma mater, Indiana University, and their famed Kinsey Institute for Sex, Gender, and Reproduction. She's also the Associate Director for the Center for Sexual Health Promotion in the School of Health, Physical Education, and Recreation, what we Hoosiers call the Hyper. I used to play hoops in the Hyper. That's also on the Bloomington campus of Indiana University. She has her own website, mysexprofessor.com, where she informs, entertains, and educates a number of men and women across the country and throughout the world. That's right. She's internationally known. She is a certified member of the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, Therapists, and she's been on many shows, including the Tyra Banks Show, NBC's Today Show, among other television talk shows. And she's also been featured as a columnist in Men's Health Magazine, Time Out Chicago, Psychology Today, Glamour Magazine, too many more to list. My guest tonight has a book coming out in just a matter of weeks entitled Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. On behalf of Upfront and Straightforward and the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network, listeners, please welcome to tonight's discussion book author and sex educator, Dr. Debbie.
Thank you. That's quite a welcome.
How are you this evening, Dr. Debbie?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm cool. Like I got a little bit for the last 3-4 weeks. I don't know if it's because I've been yelling too much or something. My voice has this minor strain to it. But anyway, other than that, I'm not going to nitpick about complaints because I'm doing fine, and I'm glad to have you on my show. Now, real quickly, what do you think about those statistics that I read about Cook County, Illinois?
Well, you know, it's always scary when you hear, about a group of people who have very high rates of infection. Of course, no one wants to get an infection. The good news, of course, is that they're curable. But, you know, but the other thing that it always makes me think of when you hear high rates is that at least there's testing there, right? There are many other places that may be coming in 5th, 10th, 20th on a list. It doesn't mean that they don't have high infections, but the Chicago area in general is really good about having healthcare available to young people regardless of their income level. So, yes, there's high rates. Yes, we need better education. But it also tells me that in Chicago we've got good access to testing and healthcare.
Mm-hmm. So, we have this in common. We're both associated with Indiana University. Mm-hmm. Now, are you a native Hoosier or no?
I'm not. I'm from Florida originally.
Florida.
So I've been in Indiana for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
So I think the Hoosiers have adopted me by now. I've certainly adopted them, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, I would say reading all I've read about you, us Hoosiers would be more than happy to adopt you because you are informing men and women about sexuality. You're entertaining them and educating them. And that's always appreciated. Now, when you were in Florida, had you become a big fan of Albert Kinsey?
I was certainly aware of Dr. Kinsey's work. I don't know that I would have called myself a fan. I think mainly just because, you know, he himself had, you know, died in the 1950s. I was always aware of the Institute's work and the legacy. Although I didn't originally start out as as someone who wanted to go into the field of sex, I wanted to be a therapist for a long time, just a general psychologist and therapist back when I was living in Florida. But I've certainly always been aware of the amazing work done by Dr. Kinsey and his team.
So what did tip your interest towards sexual research?
Just getting into it. I in undergrad at the University of Maryland, I was a psychology major, and mainly worked with children. I worked with all kinds of different kids. I worked on foster care research studies. I worked with children with autism, children with other special needs, and was just really interested in how kids learn and how they learn to talk and how they learn about different attachment issues and so on. And when I was graduating college, the Kinsey Institute out here in Bloomington was conducting a study on childhood sexual development. They were actually studying college students and asking them to look back on their childhood and asking them about different sexual games that they played, like I'll show you mine if you show me yours, and sort of this whole continuum of development up through adolescence, which interested me from a child perspective. And so I interviewed, I got the job, I thought this was great, I'm going to learn so much about, you know, children and adolescence, and then I'll go back to grad school and get my PhD in psychology and have this great career studying things related to children. And I got here and I just got absolutely sucked in by the questions and curiosities I had about the field of sexuality. You know, I didn't realize how young the field was when I started here. I didn't realize, I think, how little we actually knew about bodies. You know, it's not just the teenagers that don't know much about sex and bodies and how things work. It's all of us. And it's all of us still as a field. We are, you know, a very young field, only, you know, less than 100 years old, really, in this country. And, gosh, it was only about 10 years ago that we even discovered how big the clitoris really was. So we've got a long way to go.
I'm sorry.
It's a long-winded answer to how I got into this.
I know you were being serious, but that just sounded so funny. We did not know how big the clitoris was.
We didn't, and that's crazy. Like, this is a body part, right? As long as people have been cutting up cadavers and doing x-rays and MRIs and all these different things, how could we not have known something as basic as the size of this body part that's so central to a lot of women's sexuality? But we didn't.
Wow.
It's a lot bigger than meets the eye.
That just tells you the state of where we are.
It does.
Now, you know, on a side note, before I continue my questions, I'm going to say this on public radio. I'm going to probably try my best to weasel my way into getting some kind of two-sentence or so letter recommendation from me. Because, you know, I've been encouraged to go back to school and pursue my PhD. And if I do, that's what I want to go back to school and pursue. I want to go and apply for the program in Indiana University.
Great.
But
anyway. The field needs more good people. It really does. It's a small field.
And that's something I'm genuinely interested in. Now, let me ask you this. Do you believe, and I don't know, given your experience, this might come across somewhat of a silly question, but do you believe that it is okay for parents to talk to their teenage sons and daughters about sex in a very detailed and frank manner at the age of, say, 13, 14, or is that even too late for that talk? Well, what is the earliest age you feel parents should talk to their sons and daughters, not in that kind of cartoonish birds and the bees manner, but in a really candid manner?
Well, you know, I don't think there's a specific age. The way I look at it and the way a lot of people in this field look at it is more of an ongoing conversation. So rather than having, you know, what we think of like as the talk, you know, sitting down and imparting all this wisdom and kind of going through the facts of life and the birds and the bees, thinking about this as this ongoing conversation that happens from the time you have a very small child who's learning the names of their body parts. So that when you're teaching a very young child the names of their body parts, you don't gloss over the genitals and you don't give them some ridiculous name like PP or something like that. But you say, you know, you say penis or you say vulva. And I mean, and I'm actually a really big proponent. You know, I've been on the Tyra Banks show and I took my vulva puppet on the show and I really am a proponent of
Wait, you got it. Time out on that. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah.
You gotta briefly explain to my listeners, what is a vulva puppet?
It's a puppet. Mine is about maybe, gosh, I think they're probably 10 or 12 inches tall, so they're not life size. most people aren't that big anyway. And so it's this big, like, cushy, fluffy, soft puppet. You really can slip your hand in the back and make the vulva, you know, I guess talk or move or dance or whatever if you want to. But if they're like in these beautiful colors, mine is this rich red with like these gold labia minora, the inner vaginal lips, and a bright pink clitoris, and then this little tiny like flower thing in the middle that kind of an inside the vaginal canal, which would be the G-spot. And so it's I use it when I teach, even when I teach college students, not because, like, I put on a puppet show, because I don't, but because I think it's fun and it's disarming and it makes people laugh a little bit when otherwise they're sometimes uncomfortable about genitals. So when Tyra was doing her show called What's Up Down There last year, and they were looking for someone to talk about some health issues related to the vagina and the vulva, they had me come on and bring my vulva puppet just to briefly kind of explain the different parts to Tyra's viewers so that they could see the parts of the vulva. That's what the Wondrous Vulva Puppet is. It's pretty fantastic.
That's cool. That's very creative on your part.
Thank you. So, I didn't make it. I did buy it, but it's something I've used for years. And I do think that when you're teaching little girls, you know, the name of their body, that it's important to say vulva anyway, because it's the right term. I mean, vagina is the part inside. You can't see it. And so why do the whole boys have a penis, girls have a vagina when, you know, it's a vulva?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so so that's the start, you know, but later on there's other things. There's like good touch, bad touch when they get a little older. And then, you know, here and there they have questions about maybe like breastfeeding or tampons or periods or puberty. And so this is like this ongoing thing. And generally we don't suggest that parents give too much information at once because kids often aren't ready for the whole shebang. And they'll ask things as they become curious. And if they don't ever ask you something, maybe that's a sign that they feel embarrassed or uncomfortable, and then you start volunteering information or trying to connect them with an adult, like a teacher, an aunt, or an uncle that maybe they would feel more comfortable with. But, you know, just trying to feel like you're an askable, comfortable parent that your kids can come to.
Now, what I've noticed in some of my conversations with women I know, I hate to say it, but a lot of them have criticized their mothers and their fathers, usually their mothers, they say that they kind of dropped the ball with educating them. Do you, based on your conversations with teenagers and young adults, do you find that many young men and young women will criticize their parents for failing to provide them with a very thorough discussion about sex, pregnancy, reproduction for women, menstruation, sexually transmitted diseases?
I would say I hear a lot of young people kind of expressing disappointment in general, you know, that no one told them. Not always just about their parents, but, yeah, their parents get included in it. You know, their parents didn't tell them, their teachers didn't tell them, you know, they didn't have an older brother or sister that told them. Or if they did get information, they just felt like, looking back, they got wrong information. And, you know, and sometimes that's just kind of like, wow, I can't believe no one told me this. And maybe it's just kind of like a minor thing about sex, but sometimes it's really important. And, you know, like life-changing information. For example, one guy I remember years ago was talking to me here in Bloomington. He was a student that he was actually never my student in the classroom. He kept sort of popping up at these, like, presentations I would do in the community. Mm-hmm. And finally started talking, saying afterwards and talking to me more. And one day he told me that, you know, he was a college-age guy, but had two unplanned children. And he was, you know, making it. I mean, he was in college and he was still working full-time and he was supporting both of his children. But he was upset because he had never gotten good information about, you know, preventing pregnancy, not once but twice. You know, he really kind of, the people in his small town where he was from hadn't even given him good information about, like, about birth control even after the first unplanned pregnancy as a teenager. So he was a strong advocate for sex education for teenagers because he said, you know, people shouldn't end up like me. Like, I love my kids. I'm doing my best to support them, but it's really hard to be, you know, 22 years old and going through all of this and raising two kids and working full-time and being in school. And so sometimes, you know, the information that people are lacking, you know, it's powerful, it's life-changing, and obviously, you know, at least two, hopefully, obviously all kids are wonderful, but two wonderful children came from that. But sometimes the information that didn't get passed on is something that could have prevented someone from getting HIV or, you know, or some other really, really tough thing happening with sex. So it is important. And it doesn't happen enough. These conversations don't happen enough. I never got a sex talk ever.
Really?
Never. I got some random sex talks from school that I found a little scary. or like a little odd, I don't know. But I definitely didn't get sex talks at home, and it's something that, you know, I joke with my family about now. Like, you know, look what happens when you don't talk to your kids about sex. Like, they grow up and they become sex experts who don't stop talking about it. But, yeah, it just wasn't part of my upbringing.
Wow, that's interesting. Now, you know, on a lighthearted note, I had 2 weeks ago, I had another person in the field who she said you guys have interacted at least a couple times, Dr. Yvonne Fulbright.
Sure.
And I told her, women like you and her, you guys are changing the face of sexual education.
Well, thank you.
You know, when I was young, every time I heard the term sex education and had a vision of my madam professor, was always that Dr. Ruth image. No disrespect against her, because she's very thorough, but, I mean, you know, the older woman with glasses. But you guys look like you got a maxim in this field. I think it enhances, well, at least possibly, people's interest in the field. Should sex education ever be tailored totally differently for teenage boys and young men and teenage girls and young women, other than, of course, the obvious genitalia differences?
It's a good question. You know, I think I can understand a bit why maybe there are sometimes some separate talks around the fifth and sixth grade ages. There are times when people want to, you know, be able to ask questions just with other girls or just with other boys, and I get that. But I also think we need more opportunities for the sexes to get together, because one of the things that kids and teenagers need to learn is how to talk respectfully to other genders and how you communicate about sex. Because later on, they're going to need to communicate about their sexual needs, their likes, their dislikes, their desires, their values, their needs to wait, or their desires to go forward. And if you've never really talked to a member of the other sex about sexuality in general, even if it's not, you know, your own personal stuff, it's going to be really hard to have those conversations. So I think even getting both boys and girls in the same room and even just talking about public issues related to sexuality. You know, get 16-year-olds in the room and talk about the same-sex marriage debates that go on, or these, you know, high rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea. Just get them talking together about sex so that they can build those skills. I think that's great. But, yeah, I do think that there are times when there's also some nice, you know, positive things that can come from just being with other kids your own gender.
What efforts do you make to make yourself come across as more relatable and non-condescending to teenagers?
Huh, that's an interesting question. I don't know that I spend a lot of time thinking about how to make myself more relatable to them.
You just naturally are.
I hope I am. I think I'm a pretty casual person, so I don't think I think that's a good thing. I think that that helps with maybe the relatability factor. I also feel like, you know, I'm not afraid to say that, like, I don't know something, which is important with any group, but especially with teenagers, because they see through, they see very easily through a lot of the false fronts that people try and put in front of them and trying to act like they know everything and adults are better and blah, blah, blah. And I think it's important to sometimes just say, you know, I don't know that. Like, I'm going to find out. I'm going to get back to you. And to just respect them and their choices. I think, you know, a lot of teenagers are used to adults judging them. And I have no reason to judge people of any age or any sexual orientation or any sexual preference or any fetish or any whatever. I mean, I really could care less what people are doing sexually as long as it's consensual. And that probably comes across too. You know, I'm not out to judge them. I just honestly want to help them have more enjoyable, safer, more wonderful sex lives. Mm-hmm. Whenever they're ready, you know, not right away if they're not ready, but when they're ready.
Well, speaking of not right away, I ask you an interesting question. I was reading some reports that said that some boys and girls in today's society are having intercourse and or oral sex as early as 10 or 11 years old. And they say, I guess that's far different from, say, decades ago. What What factors would you cite as the primary cause of such early sexual activity?
Well, you know, it's something that is a puzzle to many people, and there are different ideas around what's at the root of these early sexual behaviors. I think it's important to keep in mind that this is unusual. It is very unusual for kids to be sexually active when they're 8, 10, 12 years old, even 14, in terms of having oral sex or vaginal intercourse or anal intercourse. It's rare. But when it does happen, often, not always, but in some cases, there has been a history of abuse. And so these are children who have already been exposed to some of these behaviors from an adult. And certainly there's a lack of supervision going on too. Now, most kids you can leave unsupervised for a little while. This is not going to happen. But for some kids there's often been some exposure. When I was growing up in Miami, there were some small kids that I worked with. But even those children, even though they weren't necessarily acting out sexual behaviors, even the very small ones, the 4, 5, 6-year-olds, would describe sexual acts that, as a teenager who was volunteering to work with them, I didn't even know much about those sexual acts because they were coming from, like crack homes where their mothers were prostitutes. And that's why they were taken away from the homes, and that's why they were at the place where I was volunteering with them. The percentage of young people who are having any type of like oral, vaginal, or anal sex at 10, 12 years old is incredibly tiny, and so they often do have much harder histories. Not always, but a lot of the time.
Now, on a side note to the question I asked you, one thing I found out in Saudi Arabia, they encourage marriage as young as 12, 13 years old. Is that unusual, or that's just...
It is unusual. I don't know a lot about marriage in Saudi Arabia. I have certainly read reports that some people encourage it that young, but that in general that's not a common practice. But, I don't really know much about it. I know that there's been some outrage about young girls getting married in Saudi Arabia, so that leads me to believe that it's probably not that common.
Because, I mean, we know when a young lady first begins her menstrual cycle, she is, you could say, physically mature enough to have sex. But at what age do you think a woman is emotionally mature, emotionally intelligent enough to handle the complexities of an erotically intimate relationship?
Most teenagers, I shouldn't even say most, the average age for teenagers to have sex with boys and girls is closer to late 16, early 17, which suggests that at least good portions of them are feeling some readiness. Now, kids develop differently, and just because you have a period as a girl doesn't mean that you're even in a good physical position to have, because, I mean, really, to be perfectly frank, the cervix is actually quite vulnerable, more vulnerable in teenagers than girls in their 20s. And so teenage girls are at a higher risk for infection just by nature of the vulnerability of the cervical tissue. So just because they've had periods and could technically get pregnant, doesn't necessarily mean that physically or emotionally it's a great idea. But I think things like being able to really think carefully about your feelings, about the future, which when you're very young, when you're a young teenager, you often don't have a good sense of what time is like a year from now or 5 years from now. There's definitely a different sense of time. You're not really able to do a lot of abstract conceptual thinking then either, like what if this happened or what if that happened. And the whole feelings, what it means to fall in love feels so different when you're 14 than it does when you're 17 or 25 or 35. So, there's just no right answer. There are some 16-year-olds that feel as emotionally mature as a 12-year-old and others that feel as emotionally mature as a 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. But that's the beauty of development and everyone going at their own pace.
True. Listeners, If you want to call into the show and you have a question for Dr. Debbie or a comment to make regarding this discussion, number is 646-478-5710. Again, that's 646-478-5710. I would particularly like to hear from, if you're listening to the show live, teenagers. If you're a teenager, you got a question, please call in and ask it of Dr. Debbie. Or if you're a parent and you have concerns about your son and or daughter as it relates to their sexual education, please call in 646-478-5710. I'm going to take a brief intermission break so that Dr. Debbie can get a swig of water, but I will be right back in about 3 or 4 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
Listeners, did you miss last week's episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry? Well, here's what you missed.
Proverbial bad guy.
I've never really looked at myself, to be honest, as a quote-unquote bad boy, at least not in all regards. I mean, I ain't never robbed no bank, and I ain't never... in terms of just various facets of my behavior, I wouldn't necessarily call myself that. But definitely, yeah, when it comes to sex, in many ways, I've definitely been that guy.
Okay.
Because I will push a woman's boundaries.
You know what? To be honest with you, I think most women are waiting for a man to do that. Most women want a man to do that. Most women that are coming up in the day and age where a woman is supposed to be the good girl have this idea that a man is going to bring that out of her, and she's hoping that he will.
Remember, if you miss Alan's show live, you can always download his past episodes from either iTunes.com or the blogtalkradio.com website. Mode 1!
I want to be interviewed on Alan Roger Curry's new show. I heard he's going to be a really, really naughty on this show.
Ladies, behave yourselves. We're supposed to be, you know, good girls.
I am a good girl when I'm at church, when I'm around my parents. We are good girls. We make every effort to keep our minds out of the gutter. We don't watch porn or read erotica. We are good girls.
How's it going, ladies?
Hey, Alan.
My new show, The Erotic Conversationalist, is for everyone. Prudish, the free-spirited, everyone in between. For even the good girls.
Sounds interesting.
You're so deliciously naughty.
No one.
I can't wait to listen.
My next caller, area code 310. 310. You are now up front and straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. What's your question or comment?
I used to date lots of women, both in high school and in college and in medical school, and people used to always ask me, you're not the best looking guy, you're not the richest guy out there, how are you getting all these women? And essentially the answer is actually quite simple. It's essentially having the confidence and knowing what you want to do.
Oh, thank you, thank you, Master Alan.
Ooh, say that again.
Yes, Master Alan.
Oh, say that again.
Yes, sir, Master Alan.
I like that.
Hey, buddy, thank you so much for having me. That is easily the nicest introduction that I've ever had.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio Internet Radio Network. now return to my interview with book author and well-respected sex educator, Dr. Debbie Herbinick, on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network. Welcome back to another episode of Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry. Tonight I'm conversing with a very, very, very intellectually thorough and articulate sex educator from my alma mater, Indiana University. She works with the Kinsey Institute for Sex Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction down in Bloomington, Indiana. She has her own website, mysexprofessor.com. Name is Dr. Debbie Herbinick, otherwise known simply as Dr. Debbie. And what we're talking about this evening is more or less the strengths and weaknesses of 21st century sex education. Are teenagers learning all they need to know about their sexuality, eroticism, intimacy, sexually transmitted diseases? If you want to call in and contribute to the discussion, 646-478-5710, 646-478-5710. Dr. Devin, let me ask you, over the years, I've had some male friends and female friends tell me one of two things, kind of on both extremes. Either their mother and or father discouraged them from engaging in masturbatory activities, or they had more free-spirited parents who totally encouraged it or allowed it. They just didn't want to hear all the details, but they encouraged it. What's your stance on masturbation for preteens and teenagers?
Well, you know, you can't control what someone else does with their body. So I think the idea of parents really trying to discourage it Well, I was going to say it's kind of funny because there's clearly some perception that they can control something that they can't. But the thing is, it's not funny, right? If it ends up being hurtful or, discouraging, disappointing, upsetting, causing shame maybe to kids or teenagers. The fact is that most even little kids touch their genitals. So, like I said, when I first came to the Kinsey Institute, it was to work on a study about sexual development of children and adolescents, but studying college students looking back. And what we found was consistent with other research was that, you know, large numbers of both women and men recalled touching their own genitals for pleasure, so masturbating, when they were kids, like before they even hit puberty. And there's been plenty of research in this, in both in the United States and other countries, that shows that, you know, the vast majority of like 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds are touching their genitals. So anyone that's spent a lot of time around little kids babysitting or raising their own has probably seen this. And it's a natural part of curiosity and learning about your body. And I think it's too bad when parents end up giving messages to their kids that suggest that it's bad or dirty or anything like that. Now, there's got to be boundaries, right? Like if a kid's doing this, you want to say something like, well, you know, that's okay to do, but it's, you know, it's something that you do in private, you know, in private spaces, like in your bedroom or in your bathroom, because of course you don't want them doing this like in the family room, right? Or thinking that like it's okay to do at school if they get bored. I mean, that's not okay. But, you know, but if they can learn like what's socially appropriate and what's not, then that's a good lesson about their sexuality.
I'm sorry, because I know you're not saying anything, any of this to be funny, but. Oh, that was a good one with the family room. That was, yeah, that would be kind of out of control. Let me bring race in briefly to the issue. Have you noticed any distinctive quirks that about sexuality that differ strongly, say, between Caucasians versus African Americans versus Asians versus Hispanics, or all the kind of sexuality issues universal?
They're not universal. They change with time, so it's not just race, but things do change over time. One pattern that's been fairly consistent in the U.S. but is starting to narrow in terms of being a difference is that, generally speaking, white Americans have tended to engage in more frequent oral sex, or not even more frequent, but more white Americans have been engaging in oral sex compared to black Americans. That was true in a study, a nationally representative study from the early 90s, and it's been true in more recent research too, but that gap is narrowing. I think as a culture, we're all talking a lot more about oral sex, and not just because of the Monica Lewinsky thing, but it's changed. I mean, ever since the whole HIV epidemic, people have been more openly talking about a variety of ways that you can have sex that maybe pose lower risk for things like HIV. And so, you know, oral sex in this country has become less of something that, like back in Kinsey's time in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you did after you were married, maybe, not as many people did it then, to something that more people have done. But that has been one difference by race. In terms of Hispanic individuals, there's been some suggestion. The research is a little bit less clear on here. But certainly because more often, at least in the United States, more Hispanics identify as Catholic, and maybe, and of course, people who identify as Catholic sometimes place an importance on maintaining virginity, we sometimes have seen higher rates of anal sex among Hispanic individuals compared to white or black or Asian. So there are occasional differences, but, you know, those racial differences don't necessarily hold up in other countries. One thing that I've certainly seen in some of my work and other people's research too is that sometimes the differences seem less stark by race and more stark by social class, mm-hmm. and by, you know, by where you are in terms of how much money your family has, and therefore what kind of neighborhood you're in, what kind of maybe education you're getting in school, what kind of resources you have for healthcare. So, you know, often when I've been around kids who have, you know, who are growing up in homes with not a lot of money versus those who are more comfortable in middle and or middle class or beyond, that's where I've noticed some sexual differences too.
Okay. Now, one of my guests in the last few months was an adult film legend by the name of Nina Hartley. I don't know if you're familiar.
Oh, of course. Okay. We all know Nina. I don't know her personally, but man, she's a legend.
You know, everybody says that. Even people I like would just naturally think you wouldn't remotely know that. Like, oh, yeah, I know who Nina Hartley is. Now, she said something interesting. She said she can kind of loosely compared pornography to being in the possession of a gun or a weapon. She basically said if put in the right hands and used responsibly, it can actually enhance a man or woman's sexuality and within a relationship, enhance the spice in the relationship. But if put in the wrong hands and used irresponsibly and or excessively, it could cause damage to the psyche of a young man, young woman, or a couple. Agree, disagree, partially agree. What's your thoughts and stance on porn, particularly as it relates to, say, young men and women between the ages of roughly 17 to 24?
Well, I mean, I certainly agree that there's no one way that porn is interpreted or how it's used. But I guess I would also say that that's true for almost anything about sex. You know, I think vaginal sex or kissing can be extremely connecting and wonderful and pleasurable and fun. But when used in bad ways, it can be devastating, heartbreaking, or violent. So I do think that's true about porn, but I also think that's true just about regular old sex and, you know, and other aspects of sexuality. I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what are your feelings about the factions in society that encourage abstinence until marriage? Now, from the reports I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've heard that most abstinence-oriented programs, just plain and simply, have not worked effectively. That being said, should most teenagers and young adults strive for abstinence, or is that just a personal decision? Is it impractical to strive for abstinence?
Well, there's different kinds of abstinence programs. There's abstinence only, and those programs have been shown not to work. It's kind of like, you know, no matter what, you must abstain from sex until you get married. which is problematic for so many reasons, but that is really not realistic for most people. You know, the best research out there shows that somewhere around 95% of Americans, including ones who are, you know, significantly older than you or I right now, have had sex before they got married. So to say that that's something that most people can strive for is unrealistic, especially in, you know, especially in younger generations when people wait longer to get married. Most people are not going to wait until they're in their late 20s or early 30s to have sex. So I think there's that issue. But then there's abstinence-based programs, which present abstinence as a good option for certain reasons, like, you know, reducing your risk of infection or unplanned pregnancies, or just, you know, emotional heartbreak until you're ready to have sex. But they also teach kids about birth control and about things that are different, you know, diverse types of sexual orientations and condoms, which many of the abstinence-only programs don't. And so I think those are some important differences. A lot of people in the sex research and sex education field, I think, really try to talk a lot about what we consider comprehensive sex education, which talks about more of a lifespan approach to teaching sex. So, you know, this, again, that back to that idea about, you know, talking about body parts and, you know, and then expanding the conversation as kids get older and more interested and curious about different things. So, you know, so those are kind of like the big camps in sex education right now. And I just think that, you know, there's a lot of diversity even when we talk about the abstinence stuff.
Now, you mentioned briefly when you were talking about the different ethnicity traits that a lot of Hispanics are Catholic. How big of a role do you believe that religion and spirituality should play into the curriculum for a high school level or college level sexual education program?
Well, certainly in public schools, you know, we're not, you know, religion is generally not, as far as I know, supposed to play a role in public school education. Certainly private schools that are religious-based have their own principles that, you know, that they may feel that they need to have influence all of their coursework, including sex. You know, certainly when I teach college classes, we do talk about religion. We talk about spirituality. I've sometimes, when I've taught college-level human sexuality classes, had what I call a sexuality and spirituality panel, where I'll invite religious leaders from different types of religious or spiritual paths to come in and just answer students' questions about sex and religion or spirituality. And certainly there's a lot of variability. You know, for some people, religion or their spiritual values really dictates what they feel comfortable doing or not with sex. And for others, it's just one of many characteristics, just as much as, you know, what their parents think or what they think or what their friends, you know, do sexually or what their partner wants. So it's you know, the influence is certainly variable. But in terms of what we should or shouldn't be teaching, if it's public education, my understanding is not really supposed to be part of the picture.
Now, have your studies ever indicated that, like I brought up the subject of race, let me ask you this, and you mentioned something about social class.
Mm-hmm.
Men who are, or women who were brought up by, say, a single mother or a single father versus the traditional two-parent home, does that affect sexuality in any significant way?
You know, I personally don't study a lot on kind of like the structure of someone's home and their sexuality. I'm familiar with a little bit of research, for example, on teenage girls who haven't had fathers in the home, sometimes having, you know, poor body image or having had sex earlier than some of their peers. But as far as, you know, other effects on their sexuality, I'm not really certain what else there might be.
I've been both hearing through the streets, you could say, and I think I might have even read one or two articles that are suggesting that bisexuality has become more and more popular in society in general, and particularly among the younger generation. What are your thoughts on that, if indeed you believe it's in any degree valid?
I don't necessarily know that that's true. I certainly hear people say that too. I haven't really seen the data that show that that's true. certainly some, you know, the more recent nationally representative data that we have. I have seen, I guess, I mean, it is and it isn't. I have seen, I guess, maybe more of a change that we're seeing slightly higher numbers of people identifying bisexual, especially with women, and maybe that's taking away a little bit from the number that I have identified sometimes as lesbian. So, but in terms of, you know, the population, still the majority of the population are still identifying as heterosexual. Like 95-96% of people tend to identify as heterosexual in the U.S. In terms of more recent data. I certainly think that there's, but that's identification, right? That's not necessarily behavior. So just because someone says, oh yeah, I'm heterosexual, doesn't mean that they only have sex with people of another sex. Like, they might still be doing what I think is what people are seeing and talking about more, which is, you know, this phenomenon of more girls, like, making out with other girls at parties in college and things like that. So there's a difference between how you identify your orientation and sometimes how you live it out. And just because you identify one way doesn't always tell you anything about what someone's doing sexually. So that's why even when we study sex, we don't just rely, at least our research team doesn't just rely on someone telling us what their orientation is. We ask about their behaviors because we don't find that they're always consistent with what you might expect. And so I certainly think there's been some exploration maybe that we more openly talk about now than we used to. I don't know how drastically the exploration has changed since we didn't used to have really great data on what people, you know, how people sort of explored with same or other sex people. Kinsey had pretty good data on that. But in the meantime, I think a lot of people relied on orientation.
I have a lot of male friends who openly acknowledge that they have, the ones who have daughters, that they have kind of a double standard, particularly if they have a son and a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you've heard this word, say many men might encourage their sons to be sexually active as soon as possible, because there's kind of a stigma with men being remaining a virgin indefinitely. Whereas they will conversely, you know, almost want their daughters to wear this invisible chastity belt that should remain in place until marriage. What are your thoughts on that double standard that a lot of parents, and particularly fathers, kind of put on their sons and daughters?
Well, you know, personally, I don't think steering a child either way is necessarily the way to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, encouraging a boy to have sex before he's ready might make him feel more anxious about sex. If he's not ready and he feels anxious and he feels like he has to do it, maybe he's not super attracted to the person that, you know, he's having sex with, he may have erection problems, right? Because he's not super into it, or he's nervous. He's not ready yet. And then he may start to have even more erection problems the next time, not because there's anything wrong with him, but because he's just nervous and it's now this cycle. Like, oh gosh, I couldn't keep it up the last time. Am I going to keep it up this time? And then the same thing with girls. I mean, encouraging them to wait and wait and wait and wait, even when they're feeling ready. Well, what are they waiting for? And, you know, why, I think, you know, teaching girls that they need to make sexual choices based on other people's readiness for them is not necessarily a good message to send girls. You know, I don't think we want to be raising girls who are always doing something sexual that other people are telling them that they should do, when we should maybe be encouraging both boys and girls to listen to their own readiness.
Okay. In your sexual education, say, classes, I mentioned Dr. Yvonne Fulbright, and she talked about these wide ranges of orgasmic hotspots. And the G-spot, I'm sure it's existed physically for centuries, but to me that's more of a contemporary term. Does modern-day sexual education, do you cover things like the G-spot and A-spot and all these other different spots?
When I teach college students, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about the G-spot. And it is a modern term. It was coined in the 80s. But, yeah, it's certainly been described for a long time, but it was only really named in the 80s and became really sort of part of like our cultural language about sex. But yeah, I have an enormous amount of discussion around pleasure when I teach college students. Now, when I teach younger people, it really depends what someone's asked me to come talk about. But I don't shy away from talking about issues around pleasure, even with very young children, with their parent. Well, I mean, not very young children, but like kids with their parents in the room. I've done like those like puberty talks and stuff for the 4th, 5th, 6th graders. And, you know, with the girls with their moms and the boys with their dads. And when we go over the parts of the genitals and I talk about the clitoris, for example, for women, I do say that, you know, this is just a part that's very, you know, highly sensitive and feels good for some people. And then I go on to the next body part. So, you know, I don't skip over the clitoris just because it doesn't have a function like urinating that the urethra does, or the vagina, which, you know, is where tampons may be put for, you know, girls that age are curious about periods and tampons and so on. So, you know, I think, you know, a lot of progressive sexuality educators now at least try to, again, you know, by thinking of this like long-term conversation, even just introduce this idea early on when you're talking about the body parts that, hey, there's this part, and like the only thing it does is feel good. You know, it's, you're not peeing from it, you're not birthing babies from it. Like, this is just a pleasure spot. On to the next thing. And it's sort of just weave it into everything else, and it doesn't become like this big thing anyone's focusing on, but you're at least introducing the concept. So, yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, I think in bringing in pleasure and sensation and an orgasm into conversations about sexuality. And, again, teaching college students most of the time, that's a very easy place for me to be.
Well, speaking of pleasure, listeners, when I come back from this next intermission break, I'm going to have Dr. Debbie give us just kind of a brief overview of the highlights of her upcoming book entitled Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. If you want to call in, 646-478-5710, I've seen a number of numbers, phone numbers in my queue, but every time I've checked with most of you guys, you say you're just listening. Don't get verbally shy because we're talking about sex. These are the shows that I want you to ask questions, so don't get shy and say, oh, I'm just listening. No, if you have a question, let my guests know, or you have a comment. But I'm going to take one more intermission. No, wait a minute. I was going to let Dr. Debbie pass. How could I forget this? All my listeners know my show, whenever I have a guest, they have to. Dr. Debbie, are you familiar? I have a book out entitled Mode 1, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking. And in a nutshell, it's about encouraging single men to express their romantic and or sexual desires, interests, and intentions to women in a more highly self-assured, upfront, and straightforward manner, which is where the title of the show comes from, upfront, straightforward. But anyway, this little cute little thing has become a staple of my show, where I had a guest stretch out the O's in Mode 1, and they say, Mode 1, or whatever rendition they have. So before I go on this intermission break, Dr. Debbie, give me your best rendition of Mode 1.
Okay. Can I put in a lot of O's, since I'm all about the orgasm?
Ooh, yeah.
Mo, whoa, 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 road one. How's that?
Alan Roger Curry.
Put up front, straightforward.
Alan Roger Curry.
I like that little twist Dr. Debbie had to my Mo one. But yes, callers, we are coming down to our last few minutes. So please, if you have any, you know, last-minute questions, last-minute comments about what we've discussed so far, please call in 646-478-5710, and I will be right back.
Sound off now.
Do you enjoy great music? Do you want to sound off on the issue?
Can you handle the truth through real talk, uncensored? If so, join me for the Sound Off Now show. The Sound Off Now show airs weekly on Tuesday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Real life, real talk, real issues. Again, that's every Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern at www.blogtalkradio.com/sound-off-now. Thanks, and I'll see you there. Hold up, hold up. I almost forgot about Friday nights. Hey, what's good, family? This your man, S-O-N, again. Look, after a hectic week of work and blog talk radio shows, meet me on Fridays at 12 midnight Eastern Standard Time for one of the hottest online parties on the World Wide Web. That's right, Club S-O-N, featuring one of the wildest chat rooms on the net. Check out your man, S-O-N, as I mix new and old school hip-hop, R&B, neo-soul, house, go-go, live from the Blog Talk Radio switchboard, while you enjoy all of your favorite BTR personalities in the chat room. Again, that's Club S-O-N, Friday, 12 midnight Eastern Standard Time. I will see you there.
Ladies.
Mode one.
Oh, Alan, you have such an innocent, wholesome face. Who would have known you're as nasty and freaky as you are?
I'm a good girl.
My new show, The Erotic Conversationalist, is for everyone, the prudish, the free-spirited, and everyone in between, for even the good girls.
Yes, Alan, better. You're so deliciously naughty.
Mode one.
I can't wait to listen.
Single, lonely, confused, join me. I invite you to listen to the most informative and entertaining talk radio show on the internet for single men and single women looking to enhance their social lives, love lives, and or sex lives. Get on the phone right now and tell one or two of your single friends to listen to Upfront and Straightforward with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, Thursday evenings at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central, and 7 p.m. on the West Coast, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network. Return to my interview with book author and well-respected sex educator, Dr. Debbie Herbinick, on Upfront and Straightforward with Alan Roger Curry, right here on the Blog Talk Radio, Internet Radio Network. Welcome back to Upfront and Straightforward. Right now, I'm going to go straight to the phone lines. Area code 253, you're now Upfront and Straightforward, Alan Roger Curry, and I know this area code. This is EVP3 from Seattle. What's up, my friend?
I tell you what, I'm feeling a lot of Hoosier sexuality type feeling going on here tonight. A lot of Hoosier-esque.
I like it.
What's your question and or comment for Dr. Debbie?
My question, I think it's basically twofold, but I'm just interested, Dr. Debbie, to answer the question. I'll say, start now, that I think it should happen, myself, without a doubt. But I'm wondering professionally what Dr. Debbie would say to the fact whether we should be teaching sexuality in the schools across the board. I'm talking about the U.S., does she think that should, something that should definitely place? And if so, if she could kind of expand a little bit on her thoughts on that, and maybe how it should take place. If she doesn't think it should take place, maybe she can expand on that and why.
Yeah, I do think sex education should be part of the schools throughout the country. And, you know, a natural place for it might be as part of health education. Unfortunately, not even all students get health education. There are many, you know, I was talking to some teachers the other day who were saying that at their school, the ninth graders don't get any health education. And considering that at that school, like many schools, that's when high school begins, you have all these, and, you know, in that case, for example, girls coming into a situation where they're the freshmen and, you know, there's a lot of older potential partners there and they've got no information about sex. And they have high infection rates in that grade, and they're dealing with body image issues as they go through adolescence. And there's not even basic health education. So I do think that sex education is needed, and I do think that if we could expand health education and make it every student's right to learn how to protect their bodies, whether it's from a sexually transmissible infection or hand washing things related to preventing the flu, then that would be a big step forward.
Okay, so if I'm understanding, you're saying definitely you just think it should take place, and you should think it should be a part of, for example, health education. And if, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds like you're thinking it should happen right around the beginning of high school age, or do you have feelings about that?
Well, I think there's different things that kids need to learn in different grades. I mean, there's really no need, for example, to talk to very young children about the specifics of like sexual intercourse and oral sex and things like that. But certainly high school students and in many communities, middle school students could really benefit from that information too. But very young children could benefit from learning about their body part names and about good touch, bad touch. So if we think about comprehensive sexuality education, the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States, which I know is a mouthful, but they have these amazing guidelines for how sexuality education can happen from very young ages, but giving really age and developmental appropriate information for each age group. And those are the guidelines I happen to be a fan of.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, EVP, as
Thank
always,
you.
For calling in with that question. Real quickly, as we wrap up, coming down to the last few minutes, tell my listening audience briefly about, well, I should say specifically my female listeners. Why should they? Well, first of all, I'm going to juice up her head a little bit by reading some of these testimonials I caught off of Amazon. Debbie Herbenick's book with the great title, Because It Feels Good, offers a wealth of basics for anyone returning to or embarking on what America has demonized far too long, sex for the sake of pleasure. Dr. Betty Dodson said that Debbie Herbenick is the worldly, wise, warm, witty, daring, caring older sister we all wish we'd had. She's hip to the latest toys. Ooh, latest toys and trends. But she doesn't overlook the timeless essentials, which is good communication, basic anatomy, and olive oil. See you later, Dr. Ruth. Mary Roach, tell us about Because It Feels Good.
Oh, I love my new book. I really do. I think what I like about it is that it's information that I can give to people and know that they're getting good information. There's a lot of books out there that are fun, but you can't necessarily trust everything that's in there. The information in Because It Feels Good is based on research, but it's delivered in a more accessible way. There's information about improving desire, enhancing the ability to have an orgasm, reconnecting with a partner, getting out of what I call cycles of dread, when you just dread the touch of a partner, whether it's a hug or a kiss or their attempt to have sex, preventing it to begin with, and if you're in that cycle of dread, getting out of it. There's a whole chapter on sex toys, the latest, the greatest innovations, how to use them alone, how to use them with a partner, how to choose lubricants, how to choose lubricants to use with condoms. There's a chapter in anal pleasures and anal health and things like that, and there's also a whole big chapter on tips and techniques and how to communicate what you want to do with your partner, and rather than trying some, you know, big crazy acrobatic position that you're going to like sprain your ankle or neck trying to get into or out of, basic modifications. and how you can make missionary a little bit better just by tilting your hips or by squeezing your pubococcygeus muscles or other fun little things
the
I have in there.
Muscles?
Your well, the short name is PC muscles, basically your pelvic floor muscles, and both men and women have them, and you just basically the same squeezing motion that you would do around your genitals if you want to stop the flow of urine. Everyone knows what I'm talking about, so listeners,
okay,
just try it for a sec. No one would see it if you were doing it. It's a very invisible thing. And when you contract those and then release them and contract them and release them and you practice this, for both men and women, it can enhance orgasm. For men, it can help you learn to control the timing of your ejaculation. And what's really great about them is for women, if you're doing them during sex with a man too, you can kind of like give him a little extra sensation, give him a little squeeze, and it feels good. I am all about sex feeling good, and I think what I like about this book too is that the message is not here's how to have crazy mind-blowing sex, because that's, you know, we hear that all the time and it's not realistic. And what I really want to tell people is that, you know, there is information out there that you can trust and it can help you to have better sex more of the time, but to get away from kind of like these crazy expectations that maybe make people feel a little sometimes disappointed in their sex lives, that they're not having like the craziest, most mind-blowing sex ever. I mean, that's unrealistic. Let's just have better sex more often.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has been thoroughly a pleasure to have you on my show, Dr. Debbie.
Thank you.
I wish you nothing but continued success. Listeners, if you want to find her, www.mysexprofessor.com. Dr. Debbie Herbinick. Her new book, again, is Because It Feels Good, A Woman's Guide to Sexual Pleasure and Satisfaction. Next week, listeners, last show of the summer. Last show of the summer. Then I'm going on my hiatus. Don't cry too much. You know, I know you're going to be sad. But I'm going to send you out tonight on one of my favorite songs from the movie, Knocked Up. Did you see that entertaining movie, Knocked Up? Baby, you send me. I'll see you next Thursday.
Stand adrift on memories less of you. Heart will find. What did she think she could do? I feel for her.
I really do. And I stared at the ring finger on her hand. I wanted her to be a big PM Dawn fan, but I'll have to